Okay, so welcome back. Remember, the overall project that we're working on at the moment is to develop the tools to arrive at singularity theorems. Because that's an important, singularity theorems are very important because they allow us to deduce the existence of singularities, such as black hole singularities or Big Bang singularities, even when there are no symmetries that would allow us to arrive at the exact solution. And if quantum gravity is to resolve or to remove the existence of singularities, somehow quantum gravity will have to get around those singularity theorems. So as part of this general program now, let us look at the notion of causality. Let us continue our discussion of causality. Remember, we say that a manifold, that the Lorentzian manifold is causal if it does not contain any closed causal curves. And a causal curve is a curve that may be time-like or null, or in some stretches null, in some stretches time-like. So if there are no closed time-like or null curves, then we say that the manifold is causal. So we have that causality in principle is obeyed there. A problem with that definition, though, is that it's not strict enough. That's because a Lorentzian manifold may be arbitrarily close to being acausal, to being not causal. And here's an example. Consider this can, it's a cylinder. So our space-time is a cylinder. In this case, just one plus one dimensional, where space runs in this direction and time upwards. And these little ice cream cones are not ice cream cones at all. They are the forward light cones. So I chose a few points and I drew the forward light cones, which means that if on this space-time you are sitting here, you can only go in this direction, in these directions, anything inside that light cone. That's all you can do. And then you travel this way, and then you arrive, for example, at that event. The light cone is drawn here, and you see now you can only travel this way. I mean, anywhere in that opening angle. And then you travel, you arrive at that point. Oh, now it's a little flatter here. And then maybe go further, and this is the opening. I mean, you have to travel that way, and so on, right? So, for example, this would be a feasible curve that you could travel here on this space-time. Now, what would be a closed causal curve? Well, imagine if this middle line here had light cones that are completely horizontal. In this case, you could keep traveling in this way and go around the entire can, come back at that location. So in this case, you would have done a closed time-like curve. You might think, well, time-like, didn't you say that this is the space direction? Well, not really, because you have to adapt what is space-like and time-like to what the light cones are doing. The light cones are defining what is time-like. And so you would be able to travel a time-like curve and come back to where you started. And you see, in this case here with the can, this is avoided. Because while those light cones tilt, they don't quite tilt all the way. They tilt to almost being horizontal there, but not really horizontal, and therefore you can't really make a closed time-like curve. You always have to travel upwards to some extent. You may be able to spiral here many, many, many times with very little gain in altitude, so to speak, in this direction, but it's not a closed time-like curve. However, it could be that, you know, you're arbitrarily close to it. It could be that these curves come back arbitrarily close to where the curve has already been. A geodesic may come to a very close neighborhood of a location of an event where you've already been. So in that case, we say that even though a space-time like this one is causal, it may be just barely so. It may be that in principle, there could be curves which come arbitrarily close to being closed time-like curves. Therefore, we introduce another definition, and we say that the space-time is called strongly causal if any neighborhood of any point contains a sub-neighborhood of that point such that no causal curve intersects that sub-neighborhood more than once. That's a good definition, because if that is not the case, well, then you can prove that there will be a curve which comes arbitrarily close to itself around some point, at least around some point. So in the future, starting from here, we will always require that our space-time is strongly causal. And we do that in order to keep causal curves at least a finite distance from intersecting with themselves. Now, of course, that's not an easy thing to check for in a generic space-time. And in any case, this notion is something that is still not quite satisfactory, because there are space-times which are strongly causal in this sense, which means that they do not come arbitrarily close to intersecting themselves. There's always a finite gap. However, they are still unstable. They're still unstable in the sense that if you perturb the metric just a little bit somewhere, then you would have geodesics that self-intersect. Why can that happen? Well, imagine you interfere with celestial mechanics. You give a little bit of a push or tug to the moon or Jupiter or something. That will have a ripple-on effect, and if you just wait long enough, you will see that the trajectories will actually be affected quite a lot. I mean, long enough could be really long. But even a tiniest of modification, for example, if you know that an asteroid is going to hit Earth, even the tiniest of modification could deflect it from and make it not hit Earth if you modify its trajectory early enough. Then the tiniest of modifications could do it. And so similarly here, just because a space-time is strongly causal doesn't guarantee that it is stable under perturbations of the metric. Could be that a small perturbation of the metric will make it acausal. So the solution to this is that we study these small perturbations of the metric and then impose suitable conditions. So first, let us consider perturbing the metric by taking the metric and mapping it into a new metric, G tilde, which is the old metric minus, and here you have some covariant vector, some covariant vector field, omega, which we will choose time-like for later purposes. So now we have on the same differentiable manifold, M, we now have two metric structures. We have the Lorentzian structure defined by G mu nu, but we also have the Lorentzian structure defined by G tilde mu nu. A few things to note first. We can prove that G tilde mu nu still has the same signature, so we're not actually changing the nature of the manifold completely, so it's not going from Lorentzian to Riemannian or something like that, or having two times or something. But of course, the two Lorentzian manifolds are different. And the biggest difference is, and that's the difference that is important for us, is that the light cones of G tilde are wider than the light cones of G. Concretely, what I'm saying is that there are more tangent vectors who are time-like with respect to this metric than there are tangent vectors that are time-like with respect to that metric. Let's see how that comes about. So let's see Let's take some tangent vector v at some point. I mean, these arguments go through at every point of the manifold. So at some point, we choose a vector, a tangent vector v, and we calculate its length. If it's zero, the length squared. If it's zero, the vector v is null. If it's negative, then it's time-like. So let's calculate the length squared of our vector v with respect to the metric g tilde and with respect to the metric g. So with respect to the metric g tilde, it is this expression. And given that g tilde is defined in this way, here we go, g tilde is g minus omega omega, we have that the length squared of our vector with respect to the g tilde metric is given by the length squared of our vector with respect to the g metric minus, well, you know, you have to contract the v's with the w's now, so you have this. Now, that expression is always negative. And that's because this is a number, and that's the same number, and so it's squared, so that's positive, and we have a minus sign. So the whole thing is always negative. And that means that this expression is always smaller than that expression. That's because we are subtracting here some positive piece. And this means that it is much easier for tangent vectors to be time-like with respect to g tilde than it is for them to be time-like with respect to g. You see, if a vector is space-like with respect to g, it may nevertheless be time-like with respect to g tilde, because you see, it's space-like with respect to g, but the length squared gets this thing subtracted from it. So therefore, what is space-like with respect to g may be time-like with respect to g tilde. And of course, every vector that's time-like with respect to g is also time-like with respect to g tilde, because this is only making it more negative. So in this sense, the light cone, the forward light cone, the backward light cone of the space-time with respect to the metric g tilde is bigger than the light cone is for the manifold with the metric g. But that implies that there are way more time-like geodesics on the manifold g tilde than there are on the manifold with the g. You see, the manifold with the metric g tilde has all the causal curves of the manifold with the metric g and more. It's not just geodesics, also it's just any curves, right? Because it's easier for tangent vectors to be time-like for the g tilde metric. So all of the time-like curves of the MG manifold are also time-like curves for that manifold, but this one has more. So we define then that a manifold, a Lorentzian manifold, is called stably causal if there exists such a vector field so that even MG tilde is causal. So it is called stably causal if, even when we perturb the metric, we have that there are no closed time-like curves. So there are several theorems. One is that when a manifold is stably causal, then one can prove that it is also strongly causal. Meaning that a geodesic cannot even get arbitrarily close to intersecting with itself. Geodesics always have a minimum finite distance from another. And the theorem, this second theorem says that if a Lorentz manifold is stably causal, then there exists a differentiable function f, so that the gradient of f is a path-directed time-like vector field. Or the negative of it would be a future-directed time-like vector field. And this is, of course, something that is much more practical to check than checking whether a manifold is stably causal. So what we have is that a manifold is stably causal if there exists a differentiable function f such that the gradient is a path-directed time-like vector field. And this f then can be viewed as a cosmic clock. And the gradient is basically pointing in the direction in which the time is increasing the fastest, or decreasing if you point backwards in time. So we have a cosmic clock function here. Unfortunately, there's not the existence of f doesn't mean that f is unique. So it's not like we suddenly have a unique cosmic clock. That's in fact a problem. It would be very nice if we had. I'm going on. Interesting. It would be nice to have a cosmic clock. For example, to say, well, the universe is this old or whatever. But there is no such thing. In an FRW spacetime, of course, we have a preferred time coordinate. But the universe is not FRW. It is not spatially completely flat. And it would be very nice if we had a preferred time coordinate. But we don't have a preferred time coordinate, and therefore we also don't have a preferred way of foliating space-time into space-like hypersurfaces. If there was one, a preferred way, if there was a canonical way to do that, it would be very useful, it could be very useful for purposes of perturbation theory. We wouldn't have to worry so much about gauge invariance, but as it is, we do have gauge invariance, and that led to 20 years of wrong papers that tried to do perturbation theory of the metric in expanding space-times until eventually it was figured out. And the root cause of the problem is that there is no canonical time variable in a non-symmetric generic expanding space-time.
The meeting has ended. It had only one participant for the last 3 minutes.
This is related to how you split space-time into space-like hypersurfaces, right? But that means, is this more than just time reparametrization invariance?
Yes, it is more. Because if you think of time parameterization invariance as a transformation that just maps an old time variable into a new time variable that is a function of only the old time variable, then that's too limited. In general, you can do diffeomorphisms that mix everything up. And so it's more than just reparametrizing your time variable in terms of the old time variable. It's really a 4D thing.
So this non-uniqueness is because my level sets are actually more general than defining time.
Yes, exactly. So there is no unique way of foliating space-time into space-like hypersurfaces that would have the same time variable, that would have the same time. Now, remember that we had a rather similar statement earlier in the previous lecture. Here we are saying that the spacetime is stably causal if and only if there exists a differentiable function f whose gradient is a path-directed time-like vector field. Remember that, or maybe it was two lectures ago, when we studied time orientability of a manifold. That was at the very beginning of all this business of weird time machines and things that general relativity allows, but we don't believe actually happen. So in principle, a space-time may not be time-orientable. And we had this theorem that said that the space-time is time-orientable if and only if there exists a path-pointing, just like here, path-pointing, smooth time-like vector field. It looks very much like this, right? If there is a path-directed time-like vector field. But if you look more closely, here there's no requirement that that time-like vector field is a gradient. Here we require that it's a gradient. So if we have a, a smooth time-like vector field, path-pointing a smooth time-like vector field, this guarantees that we have time orientability. And that's because we can use it as a reference. We can say that wherever this thing is pointing, that's the past. And then we can, any other time-like vector field has in its inner product either a positive inner product or a negative inner product with respect to this one, and that will give us a unique reference to say what is pointing in the same direction as this one, and then we would say that's past pointing. And if the sign is negative of the inner product between an arbitrary time-like vector and this one, then we would say it's pointing into the future. So time orientability follows just from the existence of a past-directed time-like vector field. And you see, we only have to upgrade that requirement to the time-like vector field being a gradient, and then we get a much stronger statement, which is that it's actually stable, stably causal or manifold. And maybe just for illustration, let me just come back to that picture here. You see, in this case, we get very, very close to having closed time-like curves. But these closed time-like curves would not violate time orientability, because it's still completely well-defined anyway. Even if these guys were horizontal and we would have closed time-like curves, we would still be able to tell uniquely and in a smooth way which way is the future and which way is the past. So time orientability is something different from having closed time-like paths. I went too far. A sec. Here we go. Okay. So remember, here's our plan. We assume from now on that space-time is not just causal, not just strongly causal. We assume that it is stably causal. And why did we study that? We did because we were studying inextendable curves, inextendable paths. And a path can be inextendable for three reasons, for three kinds of reasons. One reason is that the path may simply go around in circles. If there's a geodesic, for example, that just goes around in circles, well, it's not extendable. It just keeps going, and how would you want to extend it? It's just closed. So it's not extendable for that reason. And we've gone through all of what we've done now with this business of causality to exclude that case, or to deal with that case. We're assuming stable causality, therefore that's not going to happen. Now, inextendability of a path can still have two remaining reasons. One of them is that our geodesic or curve is going on forever to infinity. If it goes all the way to infinity, there's no way to extend it further. And then comes the case, the only other remaining case is the one that we're interested in, which is the case of a singularity. A geodesic may come to a halt, may come to a standstill, may not be extendable because of a singularity. So now we'll have to deal with this case, and then finally with that one. So we will continue our study of inextendable curves, geodesics in particular, and we will arrive along the way at some key concepts, such as what is a Cauchy horizon, what is global hyperbolicity. Remember previously, we considered the set of points that we called I plus of S, that can somehow be reached from a set S. And by that I mean that can be somehow reached by some actual observer, some traveler. So the causal future, the chronological future of some set of events S, is the set of all those events that can be reached by actual travelers from who start at the set of events S. So I plus is the set of points that are affected by the events that happen at S. Okay, so let me restate that. This is the set of events that are influenced or that can be influenced by stuff that happened at the events S, because from S things can travel there. Now, let us consider the set of points that can only be reached from S. So this is the set of points that can be reached from S. This is the set of points that can only be reached from S. So this is the set of points that, this is the set of events that depend on S and only on S. In other words, if you want to know what happens on that set of points that we are considering now, you only need to know what happened on S, because they depend only on S. You can put initial conditions on S and it will determine what goes on in that set. So we start with this definition. Assume that S, subset of the manifold, is a closed achronal set. So remember, an achronal set is a set whose events are connected either in a space-like or light-like way, but not in a time-like way. So no objects could travel between any two events in S. Then we say that the future domain of dependence of S is written as D plus of S, is the set of events which are such that every past inextendable causal curve through the event intersects S. So a picture is probably better than the words here. So here's our set S. And D plus of S, the future domain of dependence of S, is the set of all those events which are such that every past inextendable curve through the point P intersects S. So for example, if we are here, this event, consider a past directed curve. It will follow the past, it will go travel within the past light cone, and it will travel, you can travel like this, for example, you can travel like that, but you cannot travel like this because that would be shallower than 45 degrees. You would have to travel faster than the speed of light. You can't go that way. So you can only go this way, and sure enough, you will intersect S. Here too, if you start from here, you can travel that direction, you will eventually hit our surface S, right? If you are here, there, you are going to hit our surface S. If you are there, then yes, you can hit our surface S, but you don't have to, because you can also go that way and miss our surface S. But since the requirement is that every past inextendable curve through P intersects S, the points out here are excluded, and so are these. And so is, for example, this event, if that's a singularity. If our manifold has a hole, for example, at this point, then this definition produces a shadow here. That's because, for example, this event has, of course, lots of past-directed curves which intersect our set S. For example, from here, you can easily travel that way, or this way, or that way. But there is a past inextendable curve, namely, for example, this one, which, yeah, it's past-directed, it's a curve, but it hits the singularity where it is not extendable. And therefore, there is a past-directed inextendable causal curve which starts at our event, but which does not end on our surface. And so all those events up here have that property that they have paths which hit the singularity, and so they are excluded. Therefore, the future domain of dependence of S is only these events. So the physics of it, apart from the math, the physics of it is that if you want to know what a field does here, you only need to know what the field did here. If you know what the field did here, if you have the initial conditions, then that will allow you to propagate forward these initial conditions and deduce what the field does anywhere in here. It will not allow you to deduce what the field does over here, for example, because there you would need to know also what comes in from here, from the past, from here, and the same from there. And also, you cannot say what happened, what will happen in here, because that singularity in principle could impose some boundary conditions or something so that you may not be able to evolve things further there. For example, if you had a geodesic and shoot it off this way, it might end here, and you don't know, I mean, you can't predict anything further up there. And similarly, we define, of course, the past domain of dependence, where it contains all those events which are such that every future inextendable causal curve through P intersects S. So that it's just a flipped version where you know you have sort of a triangle coming from below. And then the full domain of dependence of S is called D of S, and it's the union of the future domain of the future domain of dependence and the past domain of dependence. And now we can look at the boundary of that set. So that would be like the boundary to this, right? I mean, we have a past domain of dependence, and in this case, the past of domain of dependence, because there are no singularities down here, the past domain of dependence would be given by just a triangle like this, and the past domain of dependence is all the events in here. The full domain of dependence is everything that's in that triangle plus all of this. And now let's look at the boundary of the domain of dependence. So let us look at the set of the latest events that are affected only by S. In other words, how far do the initial conditions that we are setting on a set S carry us? How far do these initial conditions determine everything that will happen? So we are saying, you see, what happens here is completely determined by what happened here, because the light cones have 45 degrees. So how far? I mean, everything that happens in here is completely determined by that. Up to here, all of the points inside are completely determined by what happened in here. And the boundary, this denotes the boundary, this denotes the set of all events where the threshold is reached, where you need extra information, where in order to find out what's happening here, there, out there, you would need more information than just information about what happened here. So the future Cauchy horizon of S is denoted by H plus of S, and it is the closure of the causal future of S minus the chronological past of the causal future of S. So in other words, you just take the boundary of that. You hollow it out. So here's an example. We have the causal future of S. Future domain of dependence of S here. And then we take the closure of it, and that gives us all those points here on the boundary. And then we take away everything that's in there, and then we're left with H plus of S, the future Cauchy horizon of S. Of course, the singularity itself is not part of it, because all the elements of the future Cauchy horizon of S have to be elements of the manifold. So the past Cauchy horizon of S is the set of the earliest events that only affect S. And the future Cauchy horizon is the set of the latest events that are affected only by events on S. And then the full Cauchy horizon of S is defined as the union of the future and the past Cauchy horizons of S. So that would be, in this case, this line plus that line and all of that, right? So this would be the entire Cauchy horizon of S. And either it or the filled piece, I mean, either just the boundary or the entire solid thing would be also called a causal diamond. So it's a proposition that the full Cauchy horizon of S is the boundary of the domain of dependence of S. I anticipated it earlier, but it's not trivial, and we won't prove it here. It's just a little tedious to see. Now we come to a very important definition, namely that of a Cauchy surface. So the definition is that a closed A-chronal set S is called a Cauchy surface if it doesn't have a full Cauchy horizon. Okay, so a closed A-chronal set S is a Cauchy surface if its Cauchy horizon vanishes. So if its domain of dependence has no boundary, right? So the full Cauchy horizon is the empty set. The boundary of its domain of dependence is the empty set, which is also to say that the domain of dependence of S is the entire manifold. And that, in physics terms, means that, you see, if the domain of dependence of S is the manifold, it means that if you know what happened on S, you can, in principle, having suitable evolution laws, calculate what happened in the future at all times everywhere. Because there's no shadow, there's nothing hidden there. The S is large enough so that the future domain of dependence is covering the entire manifold. There are different definitions of a Cauchy surface, but as far as I can tell, they are just differing in degree of complexity of the language, but they are the same. I think I'm following here the definitions of Wald, because I think that they're the easiest to access.
Sorry, why does it have to be closed?
Why does what have to be closed?
Not a full surface to be a Cauchy surface. Why does it have to be closed? Like, for example, for Minkowski.
No, that's right. Let me see. No, that's right. I think it doesn't have to be closed. Good point. Yeah, I don't think it has to be closed. That's right. For example, for Minkowski space, we certainly wouldn't want it to be closed. That's right. I'll fix that. Thanks.
Minkowski space, if you take the whole Minkowski space, it is both open and closed, right? So there's no problem.
Oh.
If you take the entire manifold, it's both open and closed.
Yes, yes. I will have to look into that. I will look into that. Mm-hmm. Okay, some remarks. Cauchy surfaces are important because if the conditions on a Cauchy surface are known, then, as we already discussed, then everything on M can be predicted and postdicted. But for example, for anti-de Sitter space, it wouldn't be so. It doesn't have Cauchy surfaces. But for de Sitter space, there are. And we are not living in an anti-de Sitter space, but something similar to a de Sitter space. Now, since a Cauchy surface is achronal, it can be viewed as an instant in time. The term surface is motivated by a theorem. It can be shown that in 3 plus 1 dimensional Lorentzian spacetimes, every Cauchy surface sigma is a 3 dimensional submanifold of our manifold. Now, if a manifold possesses a Cauchy surface, then it is called globally hyperbolic. We will later need that definition for our singularity theorems. Now, if a manifold is globally hyperbolic, which is to say that it has a Cauchy surface, then there exists a global time function f, which is such that the events of equal value of f, where f has fixed output, are surfaces, are Cauchy surfaces. So space-time is then naturally foliated into Cauchy surfaces, where each Cauchy surface is defined by a particular output value of the function f. And if a manifold is globally hyperbolic, then in particular it is stably and therefore also strongly causal. All right, let's get back to the main program here. After all, we are trying to identify singularities and find methods to prove the unavoidability of the existence of singularities under certain circumstances. So overall, what we are trying to do is we are studying inextendable geodesics in order to detect singularities. Because one reason for why a geodesic may be not extendable is that it has run into a singularity. There were two other reasons that we considered, and one other reason was that the geodesic was just going around in a closed time-like curve. And then we excluded that. Another possibility is that the space-time that our geodesic is just keeps running forever to infinity and may therefore not be extendable. But the case we are really interested in is, of course, the case where the geodesic is not extendable because the manifold has a singularity, has a hole. So before we get to the geodesics running into singularities, we have to avoid one more trivial case. We just have to consider that case to be able to exclude it. Namely, we want to avoid trivial cases where the manifold is ending but could be extended. You see, it could be that our geodesic is not extendable because there is a hole in the manifold, but maybe that hole in the manifold is fixable. It could also be more than a hole. It could be that we just actually have cut the manifold off. You could just take a space-time manifold and cut a piece out of it. Well, then you have plenty of geodesics that run towards that cut line and cannot be extended any further. But that would be a trivial situation. We wouldn't say that this geodesic has discovered a singularity. I mean, kind of, but it's like a handmade singularity, not something that was forced by the curvature. So we say that the manifold is inextendable if it is not isometric to a proper subset of another space-time. So in other words, if we just cut out a piece of a manifold, it could be just a point, it could be that we take a chunk of it out, then we say that the resulting manifold is extendable because we could just put back in what we cut out. For example, we could just take a point out of a manifold and then we could put it back in. So we say that a manifold is inextendable if it is not part of a bigger manifold. So for example, for a Schwarzschild solution, well, we have a singularity, but we cannot embed Schwarzschild spacetime in a larger Lorentzian manifold where everything is the same except that there is no singularity there. That's just not possible. So in order to avoid trivial cases where the singularity has holes that could be fixed, we say that a manifold is inextendable if it is not isometric to a proper subset of another space-time. And so we will always assume now that the manifold is not extendable. We will always assume that if it has holes, they cannot be fixed. I should say there is a difference between a manifold being extendable as a differentiable manifold and a manifold being extendable as a Lorentzian or Riemannian manifold. Because as a differentiable manifold, there may not be a problem. There's a hole there, you can just patch it over. But as a Lorentzian or Riemannian manifold, it could be that the curvature is diverging at that point, and that's why you can't patch the manifold. And that's not something you would see if you just look at the differentiable structure. You have to look at the metric for that. And we will later see that in action when we discuss what kinds of singularities there are. So now, a definition is that a geodesic which is inextendable but possesses a finite range of its affine parameter is called incomplete. You see, this is to exclude inextendable geodesics which keep going to infinity. In order for... we want to look at geodesics that run and run and run, and then they cannot be extended further, even though their parameter hasn't reached infinity. So the parameter is just running towards 5 or something, and then we cannot extend the geodesic. Remember that one other possibility to the presence of a singularity would be that the geodesic just keeps going. It just keeps going like in Minkowski space to future infinity, but that's a trivial reason for why the geodesic cannot be extended. Okay, so it's incomplete geodesics that we are looking for. And we say that the manifold possesses a singularity if it possesses an incomplete geodesic. And depending on the type of geodesic that discovers the singularity, we distinguish then singularities of null, space-like, and time-like types. Now, what can happen when we approach a singularity? When we're going along an incomplete geodesic towards a singularity, then one of three things can happen. Actually, they can also happen all together. But they can also happen in isolation. One of the things that can happen when you travel on a geodesic towards a singularity is that when you take the Riemann curvature tensor and you calculate a scalar from it, such as the Ricci scalar, or this quadratic expression that's scalar in the Ricci curvature, or any other scalar that you can calculate from the Riemann curvature tensor, and there are many scalars that you can build, then they might diverge. And we would then say that this is what we are approaching is a scalar curvature singularity. Remember, it's important to choose a scalar here, because if we were looking at, 1-3 component or so, we can actually make that 1-3 component look like it's divergent by just using really weird coordinates. And that's because the Jacobian factors can be chosen to be pretty much anything, because we have full freedom of any diffeomorphisms that we can apply. However, when we calculate a scalar, that's not so. The value of a scalar doesn't depend on the coordinate system in which you calculate it. So in order to check reliably whether a quantity goes to zero or goes to infinity, that quantity better not be coordinate system dependent. That's why we use scalars here. And in this way, we can identify scalar curvature singularities. But there's another way to identify singularities, which is related to this way, but not the same. Namely, we can also use the tetrad formalism, And in that case, the coefficients of our Riemann curvature tensor, but those coefficients are scalar then. They don't care about the coordinate system that you choose anymore, because we've chosen our tangent and cotangent vector spaces independently of the coordinate system. So we can also run into the situation where, as we approach on a geodesic a singularity, any one of those scalar components, or maybe its covariant derivatives, diverge. In that case, we say that we have detected a parallel propagated curvature singularity. And they're not mutually exclusive at all, just that there are more of those than of these. It could also be that we run into a singularity, but none of the above applies. It could be that all quantities that you can form from the curvature, all coordinate system independent quantities that you could form from the curvature tensor, remain finite as you approach the singularity, and yet you still have a singularity. And that would be so-called conical singularities, and you obtain them in this way. You could take, for example, a piece of paper and then roll it up so that it forms like an ice cream cone, right? Or you could cut a piece and then roll it up. I mean, see, when you take a piece of paper and roll it up to form an ice cream cone, then you have spare paper. You have paper overlapping paper. If you cut that away, then you just have like an ice cream cone. At the tip of the cone, you have a singularity. But there's no curvature on the cone at all. When you take a piece of paper and you bend it, you're not giving it curvature. Right? Because parallel transport on a bent piece of paper is not a non-trivial thing. It remains trivial. Which, by the way, means that when you take a piece of paper and you crumple it up, you're not curving it. All you do is that you put conical singularities in there, and they absorb all of what you think of as being curvature.
But that's external curvature and inner curvature, right? That's the difference between external curvature and
inner. Yes, I'm talking about the intrinsic curvature of that manifold.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
So you have to go along the specific geodesics towards the singularity. Otherwise, if you go this way, it's a singularity.
Yeah, then you don't see it then. Well, but not even curvature. You see, with paper, if you want to give paper curvature, you probably won't succeed. You will rip it before you give it curvature.
Right.
For example, if you want to give it a bulge or something, then it will probably rip before it does it. And the same is true for clothing, for example. It's difficult to cut clothes out of tissues that are not stretchable. Because, for example, if you want the clothes to just go around the shoulders, for example, then definitely there would be curvature needed, but you can't do it. If this thing is not stretchable, you can't have that it does it. So there is always going to be folds, except if you have stretchable material. Then you can actually give it curvature. Okay, so these are non-curvature singularities. And you can have everything together. You can have all three kinds of singularities all at the same time. Scalar curvature singularities, parallel transported curvature singularities, and non-curvature singularities as well. Okay, so now let's return to our fundamental problem. In concrete solutions, such as the Schwarzschild solution or the cosmological FRW cosmologies, curvature singularities are obviously present. We can just calculate the curvature scalars, for example, and they already will blow up. But then these solutions are solutions with very high symmetry, and the big question is whether more realistic perturbed spacetimes even have those singularities. That's actually the topic that Stephen Hawking wrote his PhD thesis about. So for example, we could look at spherical symmetric distributions of dust. And let's say this dust is then infalling. And according to Newtonian gravity, you would expect that because this shell of dust is infalling, eventually everything will arrive at the center of the sphere at the same time and produce an infinite mass density there. However, Newton's theory would also predict that if your initial spherical mass distribution, dust distribution, wasn't exactly spherical, then, but generically deformed, then things would not generally form this infinite mass density at any point. In fact, the classical theory that studies when, under what circumstances you have infinite densities arising from almost but not completely symmetric circumstances is called catastrophe theory. So it can happen, but it wouldn't happen in this case. Now, in Einstein gravity, we need to study singularity theorems to determine whether or not singularities are avoidable. Indeed, there are such theorems that predict the existence or the occurrence of a black hole singularity even when the symmetry of the initial conditions is perturbed. However, something's got to give. We cannot solve the equations of motion in general when there's no symmetry. So how can we make any statement about the later behavior without actually solving the equations? And what we will find is that two ingredients are needed. One, of course, is the Einstein equations. And the other is some assumption about how matter behaves. And that assumption typically takes the form of the dominant energy condition or strong energy condition or some kind of condition on the energy momentum tensor. And then if you put that together with the Einstein equations, then with a little luck, you can prove that space-time will develop singularities. And what this then will tell us is that in order to avoid singularities from forming, gravity effects should somehow violate either the Einstein equations or those energy conditions, or both. Yeah, so the aim is to either predict the formation of a black hole or to post-dict a cosmological Big Bang singularity on the basis of the Einstein equations together with some assumptions about matter in the form of an energy condition. Yeah, I just said that. Okay, so what is our strategy then for singularity theorems? Well, first of all, we are going to focus attention on singularities that can be detected by inextendable time-like or null geodesics. And the reason is that this would be singularities that would affect us as astronauts. If we travel, and then we are going to be on a time-like curve. Or if we send out light, it's going to be on a null curve. And so we are asking, what singularities could time-like or null geodesics detect? So which could we detect or our instruments? The usual singularity theorems are also not concerned with singularities that would be detected by space-like geodesics. I don't actually know what they would mean. I don't really have a good intuition for what a singularity would be like that can only be detected by a space-like geodesic, but not by a time-like one. Okay, so the basic idea was that singularities can be detected because they are in the way of geodesics, so that they cannot be extended. The presence of singularities, in particular, interferes with the property of geodesics of being curves of extremal length. Remember? See, we're going here through A, B, C, D, etc., just going through the strategy that we are employing here. Remember that the geodesic equation can be arrived at by extremizing the length of a curve that's being traveled. And the differential equation is, and the geodesic equation is a differential equation. Now, some people don't know that the time-like geodesics that an astronaut would travel on are actually not curves of minimal eigentime, but they're curves of maximal eigentime. So geodesics are arrived at not by requiring that the eigentime, that the proper time traveled is minimal, but it's actually maximal. Whereas for space-like geodesics, they are curves of shortest proper distance. Next point is that even in generic space-times, there always exists, let me see if I should go through that argument too. Okay. So why is the proper time between two events maximized by a time-like geodesic? Well, you could always reduce the proper time that it takes you to travel from one event to another event by, instead of traveling on a geodesic, traveling on a detour. If you travel a detour between your two events, you have a longer distance to travel, but you'll travel it faster. Okay? But if you travel it faster, you have less proper time that passes for you. So the it's easy to spend less proper time than a geodesic does between two events. And a geodesic is maximizing the proper time that it takes you to go from one event to the next, from the starting event to the end event. Then, even in generic space-times, we have that there always exist curves of maximal length between two events. So that's just these are geodesics. And then what assumptions are needed? The assumption that will be needed is that space-time is globally hyperbolic. That's not necessary, but it's a sufficient assumption. And finally, or almost finally, and I mentioned that just a few minutes ago already, anticipating it, a crucial ingredient in proving singularity theorems is that we make the assumption that matter obeys certain energy conditions. And these energy conditions are important to prove that geodesics have a certain property, which is called the expansion. So the energy conditions are ultimately needed to be able to prove that the expansion of geodesics, which is their tendency to either diverge from each other or converge to each other, depending on the direction of time that you're looking at, this divergence of geodesics can blow up. And that means that the geodesics then cannot be extended beyond that blow up, and from that we can infer the existence of a singularity. This is going to be a non-trivial business here, because when you start with two geodesics that are very close to each other, that start out basically parallel, but from points that are slightly offset to each other, then because space-time has curvature, the two geodesics will not just stay parallel in the same way always. But instead, what can happen is that they drift apart from each other, or they come closer. So you can have that it's, you know, a divergence or a convergence of them. But they can also rotate about each other. And if you have, let's say, not just two geodesics, but a whole ring of geodesics, that whole ring of geodesics could go larger, it could go smaller, but it could also get squished in this way or in that way and rotated. So, and all those things will come up, and we'll have to focus on the expansion of it, because that's what matters. Will those geodesics crash into each other? Like in particular, when we ask about the Big Bang singularity, then we follow geodesics back in time. And we are then wondering, will there be geodesics that crash into each other in a finite amount of time? And so we will look into the expansion parameter to detect that. Right. Yeah, and then finally, once we detect that, we want to detect a divergence in the expansion rate, then we have detected a geodesic. Okay, so we are ready now to formulate one of those singularity theorems. Let us assume that the space-time is globally hyperbolic, so it has a Cauchy surface. And let us assume that the energy momentum tensor of matter obeys the so-called strong energy condition. Remember, we had the weak energy condition, we had a dominant energy condition. That's a new one, the strong energy condition. And the previous energy conditions had some nice interpretations, such as we want that the energy density is always positive, or we want that the flow of energy is always towards the future. And these were the energy conditions that we had already. This is a different energy condition, and we will discuss a little later how it's related to the other ones. And the answer is not easily. It's not that it implies the other energy conditions, or they imply that, not at all. No, this energy condition, unfortunately, or fortunately, we see, this energy condition that we will need for that singularity theorem, this energy condition is designed so that in a crucial step of the proof of the existence of singularities, we have just the right assumption made so that we can go further in a certain step. So it's not that this energy condition has an obvious physical meaning. It's really chosen for mathematical convenience. Now that sounds unfortunate, but on the other hand, because it's such a weird thing that cannot be, as far as I know, cannot be directly physically motivated, it can easily be that this energy condition is violated once we take into account effects of quantum gravity, or at least effects of quantum theory. Because it's not something that everybody would say because of physical reasons, yeah, that's got to be true. Energy's got to flow into the future, for example. It's nothing like that. So it wouldn't violate any fundamental principles, any very deep-seated principles, to have this violated. It's usually obeyed by whatever matter you write down. But I'm just saying that if you work with quantum fields and calculate their energy momentum tensor, then it can easily be the case that there are states of the quantum field, maybe exotic states, but states that violate that condition, especially if we take into account effects that gravity may have on quantum fields. All right, so the singularity theorem says that if our Lorentzian space-time is globally hyperbolic. And this strong energy condition holds, which is to say that when we contract this particular tensor with psi mu, psi nu, and psi is any arbitrary time-like vector field, then this ought to be positive. And these other conditions hold. I'm telling you in a moment what they mean. I have to say more about this, sorry. Okay, energy momentum tensor. So this is written specifically in T because we want an energy condition, because we want to say that the only assumptions that will go into our singularity theorem are the validity of the Einstein equations and this condition on matter. But if you look at it closely, you see that this is not truly a condition on matter, because this really is the Ricci tensor. If you remember, in 3 plus 1 dimensions, the Einstein equation can be written in the form, this is equal to some number times the Ricci tensor. Remember that? That only in 3 plus 1 dimensions is it true that there is a duality in the Einstein equation. You can write it either in the standard form, where you have r mu minus 1 half g mu r equal to the energy momentum tensor, or you can write the same thing with T and R interchanged. And of course, the 8 pi g goes into another constant then. And that's what we have here, T mu nu minus 1 half the trace of T times G mu nu. So this is really just the Ricci tensor. So the obvious meaning of this is not that it says something about matter, it's an assumption about the Ricci tensor. And that's what we need. We need a particular assumption about the Ricci tensor in order to know something about curvature and therefore to know something about the geodesics. See, I'm trying to highlight here the weaknesses of the argument, because ultimately, if quantum gravity is to resolve or remove the need for singularities, then it'll have to go around these things and exploit those weaknesses. All right, so further among the assumptions for the singularity theorem is the assumption that there exists a twice differentiable space-like Cauchy surface sigma on which the trace of the extrinsic curvature k is bounded from above by a negative constant c. Now that may look like as horribly technical thing, and why on earth would that hold? Well, you have to put that in context. This is an assumption about the initial condition, right? The singularity theorems are not saying, well, under whatever circumstances, there's going to be a singularity. No, the singularity theorems have three ingredients: the Einstein equation, an energy condition, and some knowledge of what the initial conditions are. For example, do we have an initial shell of matter that's infalling, or do we have a universe full of some energy content and we want to run that backwards to see if there was a Big Bang singularity? So this is a description of the initial conditions that is general enough to allow for situations where there is no symmetry. So the assumption is that there exists a C2 space-like Cauchy surface sigma on which the trace of the extrinsic curvature k, and the extrinsic curvature is the curvature between the Cauchy surface and the manifold in which it is embedded, essentially the expansion rate, just in terms of physical visualization, is bounded from above by a negative constant c. So basically, the assumption is that the universe at some point in time, and point in time is supposed to be well-defined in the sense that it is a Cauchy surface. So the assumption here is that at a certain point in time on a certain Cauchy surface, we had the extrinsic curvature translation that the expansion rate was such and such. At all points of that Cauchy surface, so at that point, at all points in time, at all points in space, then the conclusion is that that universe must have had a singularity in the past. It must have come from a Big Bang. So let's see. So the conclusion of the theorem is that no past-directed time-like curve from the space-like hypersurface sigma can have an eigentime or proper time or proper length larger than 3 over C. So the C was bounding the expansion rate. And here it tells us how old the universe can at most have been. By saying that, no geodesic is older than that much. Because if you go back, any past-directed time-like curve from our space-like hypersurface, any time-like past-directed curve from our space-like hypersurface backwards cannot be older than 3 over C. So all past-directed time-like geodesics are incomplete. And that means that the conclusion of the theorem is that there has to have been a cosmological singularity in the finite past. And that's because all past-directed paths end on that cosmological singularity. I think we are basically out of time for today. We didn't do a break. So we will continue on Tuesday then with a quick review of the extrinsic curvature and just all the examples, all the definitions that we had here. I will illustrate these things. And then we actually prove it. And we will look at the geodesics and how they behave. I mean, we will look at a bunch of geodesics that start out like parallel, and then we see what happens to them. As I said, you could have a ring of geodesics, for example, and then see how it gets squished and expands and shrinks. And then the aim will be to study how, if you go back in time, those geodesics, a ring of geodesics would shrink, and eventually that would become singular, and you would arrive at the conclusion that there has to be a singularity. All right, that's as far as we got today. See you then. Any questions? Yes?
On the picture that you showed earlier where we were talking about the coronal set S, you know, with the triangles,
yeah,
and the singularity, how would the Cauchy surface look like if it has a domain of dependence as the entire manifold? How would it look like on that picture, I'm wondering?
Oh, it would stretch to infinity to the right and to the left.
And would that, like, stretching get rid of the effect of the singularity? So that shadow that it was casting?
No, it would still be a shadow.
It would still be a shadow.
Yeah. Because it's, yeah, it's also 45. I mean, above the singularity, you get this shadow. Yeah?
For the singularity, like, the geodesic incompleteness, right? How do I distinguish, like, a true geometric, like there's a singular thing that we cannot get past versus, like, for some reason, I have two geodesics that just cross each other and flow past. That would also be singular in the ODE sense, right? Like when I have caustics.
Yes, but that wouldn't prevent geodesics from being extendable, right? They would just continue. They would cross each other and they would just continue.
I cannot follow through the proper time, right? Because once I evolve to that point where it crosses, then the ODE cannot decide which one to go.
Yes, that's right. Yes, but that's not how we are detecting it. So basically, what you're talking about is the boundary of a region of geodesic convexity,
yeah.
Right? And yeah, but that's not the methods we use.
So that's also different from geodesic incompleteness.
Yes, it is. Yes. No, the methods that we will use are based on the Ray-Chowdhury equation, which is of interest in its own right, not just for the purpose of predicting the presence of singularities, but also because it just generally explains how matter is flowing in a curved background. For example, for supernova calculations and things like that. Okay. Actually, the thing is, we actually are doing very well in the time, probably because we always went over time previously. So we're doing quite well in the time. So I think we can slow down a little bit because we still have... I mean, if I look at the time budget, how many lectures we still have and how much material, so we don't have to rush anymore. Okay?